in the words of James Bryce, had become the head of the nation. Speaking in Badgett's vernacular, Bryce also observed, "The president has a position of immense dignity, an unrivaled platform from which to impress his ideas, if he has any, upon the people. His influence could therefore be nearly total. As he has the ear of the country," Bryce wrote, "he can force upon its attention questions which Congress may be neglecting, and if he be a man of constructive ideas and definite aims, he may guide and inspire its political thought." In a 21st century hour, when the presidency has more in common with reality television or professional wrestling, it's useful to recall how the most consequential of our past presidents have unified and inspired with conscious dignity and conscientious efficiency. Every hope and every fear of his fellow citizens, almost every aspect of their wealth and activity, falls within the scope of his concern, indeed, within the scope of his duty, Harry Truman said. Only a man who has held the office can really appreciate that. Reflecting on his historic push for civil rights after President Kennedy's assassination, Lyndon Johnson recalled, "I knew that, as president and as a man, I would use every ounce of strength I possessed to gain justice for the black American. My strength as president was then tenuous. I had no strong mandate from the people. I had not been elected to that office. But I recognized that the moral force of the presidency is often stronger than the political force. I knew that a president can appeal to the best in our people or the worst. He can call for action or live with inaction." To hear such voices is to be reminded of what we have lost, but also what can one day be recaptured. The possibilities of a powerful president informed several of Hamilton's contributions to the Federalist, his joint effort with Madison and John Jay to support the ratification of the Constitution. Hamilton defended Article II, the establishment of the executive, with characteristic eloquence. In his Federalist, published on Tuesday, March 18, 1788, Hamilton wrote, "Energy in the executive is a leading character in the definition of good government. It is essential to the security of liberty against the enterprises and assaults of ambition, of faction, and of anarchy." Still, Hamilton's enthusiasm had its limits. 8 days later, in a subsequent Federalist essay, he observed, "The history of human conduct does not warrant that exalted opinion of human virtue which would make it wise in a nation to commit interests of so delicate and momentous a kind as those which concern its intercourse with the rest of the world to the sole disposal of a president of the United States." The founders saw, then, that the executive office would require check and balance. With Hamilton and Madison's counsel, President Washington gave the institution its founding form. "As the first of everything, in our situation, it will serve to establish a precedent," he wrote Madison. "It is devoutly wished on my part that these precedents may be fixed on true principles." As Thomas Jefferson, the first Secretary of State, recalled it, Hamilton once said that the president was the center on which all administrative questions ultimately rested, and that all of us should rally around him and support with joint efforts measures approved by him. In 1792, when farmers in western Pennsylvania were gathering forces to rebel against a federal excise tax on whiskey, Hamilton urged Washington to take a direct hand. "Moderation enough has been shown. It is time to assume a different tone," Hamilton argued. "The well-disposed part of the community will begin to think the executive wanting in decision and vigor." Washington agreed, writing, "Whereas it is the particular duty of the executive to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. The permanent interests and happiness of the people require that every legal and necessary step should be pursued to avoid violent and unwarrantable proceedings. Within 2 decades, Thomas Jefferson, after serving in the highest office himself for 8 years, had come to share something of Washington's understanding of the presidency. In a government like ours, it is the duty of the chief magistrate, in order to enable himself to do all the good which his station requires, to endeavor, by all honorable means, to unite in himself the confidence of the whole people, Jefferson wrote in 1810. This alone, in any case where the energy of the nation is required, can produce an union of the powers of the whole and point them in a single direction, as if all constituted but one body and one mind. And this alone can render a weaker nation unconquerable by a stronger one. Many of even our most divisive figures have drawn on this Jeffersonian vision. Before Andrew Jackson, for example, power tended toward the few, whether political or financial. After Jackson, government, for better and for worse, was more attuned to the popular will. In the American experiment, Jackson proved that a leader who could inspire the masses could change the world. He was the most contradictory of men. But then, America was and is among the most contradictory of nations. He had massacred Indians in combat, executed enemy soldiers, fought duels, and imposed martial law on New Orleans. A champion of even the poorest of whites, Jackson was an unrepentant slaveholder. A sentimental man who adopted an Indian orphan, he was one of a line of leaders who drove Native American tribes from their homelands. An enemy of the Second Bank of the United States, Jackson would have given his life to preserve the central government. Jackson spoke passionately of the needs of the humble members of society, the farmers, mechanics, and laborers, and made the case for popular politics and a more democratic understanding of power. He did so in part because he had begun his life as one of that humble class. A self-made man who had risen to the highest levels of a slaveholding society, he wanted to open the doors of opportunity for men like him. Today we find many of his views morally short-sighted, but in his time he was a figure of democratic aspiration. In the presidency, compromise was a little remarked Jacksonian virtue. No other president fulminated more passionately or threatened his foes more forcefully, but Jackson believed in the Union with all his heart. To him, the nation was a sacred thing, hallowed by his family's blood, for he had lost his mother and brothers in the Revolutionary War. We were then, and are now, what Jackson called one great family. To Jackson, anger could be a means to an end. He understood himself and how others saw him, and he turned his vices into virtues. In facing down disunionists in South Carolina in 1832-33, Jackson thundered on about leading troops into the state and hanging his opponents. Yet in the evenings, in the White House, he wrote carefully constructed letters to his allies on the ground about how to bring the crisis to a peaceful resolution. In the first days of December 1832, Jackson was standing at his desk in his office on the second floor of the White House, a steel pen in hand, drafting what would become an essential document in the story of presidential power. South Carolina was threatening to nullify federal law, a tariff to which the state objected, and Jackson believed the maneuver an unacceptable blow against national authority. In a draft of his message to South Carolina, he wrote that he was speaking with the feelings of a father when he argued that nullification was incompatible with the existence of the Union, contradicted expressly by the letter of the Constitution, unauthorized by its spirit, inconsistent with every principle on which it was founded, and destructive of the great object for which it was formed. He wrote so quickly that the ink did not have time to dry before he was on to the next page. The proclamation was intended to put down rebellion and to put the presidency itself in the breach, defending both the ideal and the reality of the Union. Jackson believed his was the only voice in the country that could speak decisively in such a moment. "The president," Jackson wrote elsewhere, "is the direct representative of the American people," an innocuous observation from the perspective of the 21st century. But in Jackson's time, the assertion of the centrality of the president in the American system was controversial. The claim provoked fury from John C. Calhoun, Jackson's great rival and the architect of nullification. "Infatuated man," Calhoun said on the floor of the Senate, "blinded by ambition, intoxicated by flattery and vanity. Who that is the least acquainted with the human heart, who that is conversant with a page of history, does not see, under all this, the workings of a dark, lawless, and insatiable ambition?" The nullification crisis with South Carolina, the president believed, was an existential moment for the Union. "If I can judge from the signs of the times, nullification and secession, or, in the language of truth, disunion, is gaining strength," Jackson wrote his Secretary of War, Lewis Cass. "We must be prepared to act with promptness and crush the monster in its cradle before it matures to manhood." In the proclamation, issued on Monday, December 10, 1832, Jackson called on South Carolinians to think of more than self-interest. "Contemplate the condition of that country of which you still form an important part. Consider its government, uniting in one bond of common interest and general protection so many different states, giving to all their inhabitants the proud title of American citizen, protecting their commerce, securing their literature and their arts, facilitating their intercommunication, defending their frontiers, and making their name respected in the remotest parts of the earth. Consider the extent of its territory, its increasing and happy population, its advance in arts which render life agreeable, and the sciences which elevate the mind. See education spreading the lights of religion, morality, and general information into every cottage in this wide extent of our territories and states. Behold it as the asylum where the wretched and the oppressed find a refuge and support. Look on this picture of happiness and honor and say, we too are citizens of America." Taken together, the Nullification Proclamation of 1832 and Jackson's conviction that the presidency was the ultimate repository of the interests of the people gave his successors precedence for bold action in consequential times. And, critically, Jackson had spoken in the vernacular of hope and of unity to combat fear and disunion. To him, it was a father's role and a president's. As did so much else, it fell to Abraham Lincoln to bring together the elements of the presidency that Jefferson and Jackson had articulated. The interval between Jackson and Lincoln had been largely marked by a Whig retreat from using executive power, a pattern rooted in the very foundation of the Whig, that is, the anti-Jacksonian, party. In a series of executive actions during the Civil War era, ranging from summoning the militia to suspending the right of habeas corpus to, most notably, the emancipation of slaves in the seceded states, Lincoln broadly drew on Jefferson's and Jackson's examples. "Certain proceedings are constitutional when, in cases of rebellion or invasion, the public safety requires them, which would not be constitutional when, in absence of rebellion or invasion, the public safety does not require them," Lincoln remarked in 1863. He increased his power in the broadest of causes, not only the rescue, but also the redemption and rededication of the Union. At Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, on Thursday, November 19, 1863, the President invested the Civil War with overarching meaning. Gone was the temporizing of his first inaugural, with its reassurances that slavery could stand in the places where it had taken root. To the Lincoln of Gettysburg, the war was no ordinary contest. It was not about territory or spoils. It was not about the boundaries of a nation or the control of its commerce. It was, Lincoln was saying now, about democracy and equality. 47 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal, Lincoln said in words that would live ever after. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation, or any nation so conceived and so dedicated, can long endure. The task of the present generation, Lincoln said, was to ensure that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. 15 months later, in his second inaugural, Lincoln continued his theme of calling on our better angels from 4 years earlier. With malice toward none, he said, with charity for all, with firmness in the right as God gives us to see the right, let us strive on to finish the work we are in, to bind up the nation's wounds, to care for him who shall have borne the battle and for his widow and his orphan, to do all which may achieve and cherish a just and lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations. Stirring words, but the work of peace was just that, work, an unfinished effort to reunite America, to confront the legacy of slavery, to rebuild the South, and to press on through shadow and twilight. The President's commitment to making that perilous journey was clear to his contemporaries, even those who sometimes found him, with his political sensitivities and calculations, too much the compromiser. After delivering the second inaugural, Lincoln received Frederick Douglass at the White House. What, Lincoln asked, had Douglass, himself one of the great orators of the day, made of the speech? No sycophant, he had fearlessly pressed Lincoln face to face on important questions in the past, including the unequal treatment of black soldiers in the Union Army. Douglass rendered his verdict. "Mr. Lincoln," Douglass said, "that was a sacred effort." It was surely that. Yet Douglass's considered view of the great emancipator in the years to come sheds light on the enduring ambiguities within the American soul. In April 1876, on the 11th anniversary of Lincoln's assassination, Douglass spoke at the unveiling of a statue of Lincoln on Capitol Hill. To be known as the Freedmen's Monument, it was paid for by donations from former slaves. "Truth is proper and beautiful at all times and in all places," Douglass said, "and it is never more proper and beautiful in any case than when speaking of a great public man whose example is likely to be commended for honor and imitation long after his departure to the solemn shades, the silent continents of eternity. It must be admitted, truth compels me to admit, even here in the presence of the monument we have erected to his memory, Abraham Lincoln was not, in the fullest sense of the word, either our man or our model. In his interests, in his associations, in his habits of thought, and in his prejudices, he was a white man." Douglass continued, "He was preeminently the white man's president, entirely devoted to the welfare of white men. He was ready and willing at any time during the first years of his administration to deny, postpone, and sacrifice the rights of humanity in the colored people to promote the welfare of the white people of this country. The race to which we belong were not the special objects of his consideration. Knowing this, I concede to you, my white fellow citizens, a preeminence in this worship at once full and supreme. First, midst, and last, you and yours were the objects of his deepest affection and his most earnest solicitude. You are the children of Abraham Lincoln. We are at best only his stepchildren, children by adoption, children by forces of circumstances and necessity. Despite all this, Lincoln had come through in the end, Douglas said, and liberated a people. Addressing white America, Douglas said, "While Abraham Lincoln saved for you a country, he delivered us from a bondage." Though a white man with many of the prejudices of white men, Lincoln had proved worthy of the trust of an oppressed race. Our faith in him was often taxed and strained to the uttermost, but it never failed. We saw him, measured him, and estimated him, not by stray utterances to injudicious and tedious delegations who often tried his patience, not by isolated facts torn from their connection, not by any partial and imperfect glimpses caught at inopportune moments, but by a broad survey, in the light of the stern logic of great events, and in view of that divinity which shapes our ends, rough-hew them how we will, we came to the conclusion that the hour and the man of our redemption had somehow met in the person of Abraham Lincoln. Douglas understood history and the men who made it. Perfection was impossible. Greatness was reserved for those who managed to move forward in an imperfect world. His great mission was to accomplish two things. First, to save his country from dismemberment and ruin, and second, to free his country from the great crime of slavery. To do one or the other, or both, he must have the earnest sympathy and the powerful cooperation of his loyal fellow countrymen. Had he put the abolition of slavery before the salvation of the Union, he would have inevitably driven from him a powerful class of the American people and rendered resistance to rebellion impossible. Viewed from the genuine abolition ground, Mr. Lincoln seemed tardy, cold, dull, and indifferent. But measuring him by the sentiment of his country, a sentiment he was bound as a statesman to consult, he was swift, zealous, radical, and determined. The trust that Abraham Lincoln had in himself and in the people was surprising and grand, but it was also enlightened and well-founded. He knew the American people better than they knew themselves, and his truth was based upon this knowledge. Shot on Good Friday, 1865, the 16th president has loomed over the White House as grandly and as completely as he does over American history itself. He was a vibrant presence in the imagination of Theodore Roosevelt, the most compelling personality to hold the office since April 1865. In some ways, a creature of his time, especially as an adherent of ultimately discredited theories of genetic white superiority, T.R. was also an unabashed champion of progressive causes and delighted in the possibilities of the presidency as a bully pulpit. He had used the phrase one evening in his library while reading over a draft of a presidential message. As a friend recalled, T.R. had just finished a paragraph of a distinctly ethical character when he suddenly stopped, swung round in his swivel chair, and said, "I suppose my critics will call that preaching, but I have got such a bully pulpit." Then he turned back to his reading again. T.R. recalled the typical American for whom he had governed. In his autobiography, the former president reprinted a cartoon of an elderly, bewhiskered man, his feet by a fire, reading a copy of the president's message in a newspaper. The caption, "His favorite author." T.R. loved it. "This was the old fellow whom I always used to keep in my mind," Roosevelt recalled. He had probably been in the Civil War in his youth. He had worked hard ever since he left the army. He had been a good husband and father. He brought up his boys and girls to work. He did not wish to do injustice to anyone else, but he wanted justice done to himself and to others like him. And I was bound to secure justice for him if it lay in my power to do so. T.R. firmly believed in the centrality of his office and of himself. He was, he said, a president in the mold of Jackson and of Lincoln, not of James Buchanan. "I declined to adopt the view that what was imperatively necessary for the nation could not be done by the president unless he could find some specific authorization to do it," Roosevelt recalled. "My belief was that it was not only his right, but his duty, to do anything that the needs of the nation demanded, unless such action was forbidden by the Constitution or by the laws." As a political scientist before entering the arena, Woodrow Wilson wrote insightfully about the national experiment. "In principle," he observed in Constitutional Government in the United States, the series of lectures he published in 1908, "the American system was Newtonian, balanced, ordered, immutable. Every sun, every planet, every free body in the spaces of the heavens, the world itself," Wilson wrote, "is kept in its place and reined to its course by the attraction of bodies that swing with equal order and precision about it, themselves governed by the nice poise and balance of forces which give the whole system of the universe its symmetry and perfect adjustment." In practice, though, things were very different. "The trouble with the theory is that government is not a machine, but a living thing," Wilson said. "It falls not under the theory of the universe, but under the theory of organic life. It is accountable to Darwin, not to Newton. It is modified by its environment, necessitated by its tasks, shaped to its functions by the sheer pressure of life. Government is not a body of blind forces. It is a body of men, with a common task and purpose." Wilson continued, "Fortunately, the definitions and prescriptions of our constitutional law, though conceived in the Newtonian spirit and upon the Newtonian principle, are sufficiently broad and elastic to allow for the play of life and circumstance. Though they were Whig theorists, the men who framed the federal Constitution were also practical statesmen with an experienced eye for affairs and a quick practical sagacity in respect of the actual structure of government, and they have given us a thoroughly workable model. If it had, in fact, been a machine governed by mechanically automatic balances, it would have had no history. But it was not, and its history has been rich with the influences and personalities of the men who have conducted it and made it a living reality. The government of the United States has had a vital and normal organic growth, and has proved itself eminently adapted to express the changing temper and purposes of the American people from age to age." Wilson also discussed the ideal role the president could play. "His position takes the imagination of the country," he said. "He is the representative of no constituency, but of the whole people. When he speaks in his true character, he speaks for no special interest. If he rightly interpret the national thought and boldly insist upon it, he is irresistible. And the country never feels the zest of action so much as when its president is of such insight and caliber." Which makes the character of the president critical, and character manifests itself in temperament. On Wednesday, March 8, 1933, the newly inaugurated 32nd President of the United States, Franklin D. Roosevelt, called on retired Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr. The two men chatted a bit. Roosevelt asked about Plato, whom Holmes was reading. and FDR sought counsel on the crisis of the Depression. "Form your ranks and fight," Holmes advised. After the president left, Holmes was in a nostalgic mood. "You know, his cousin Ted appointed me to the Supreme Court," Holmes remarked to a former clerk. The justice then added, "A second-class intellect, but a first-class temperament." Temperament is one of those terms that brings the late Supreme Court Justice Potter Stewart's definition of hardcore pornography to mind. We know it when we see it. Or, in this case, sense it. The word itself derives from the Latin, meaning due mixture. Discerning human temperament is more a question of intuition and impression than of clinical or tactile perception, and it is a chancy undertaking. As Justice Holmes noted on that early March day in 1933, though, it is a vital one. And FDR's was indeed first rate. Like most politicians, it is true, Roosevelt loved attention and approval in equal measure. Once, after watching himself in a newsreel, he remarked, "That was the Garbo in me." On meeting Orson Welles, the president called out, "You know, Orson, you and I are the two best actors in America." Reflecting on Roosevelt's determination to seek a third and then a fourth term as president, Harry Truman observed, "I guess that was his principal defect, that growing ego of his, which probably wasn't too minuscule to start with, though perhaps it was his only flaw." FDR had the gifts of self-knowledge and a compassion for the plight of others, saving graces that enabled him to become one of a handful of truly great and transformative presidents. As important as he believed popular leadership to be, the fireside chats, the careful cultivation of public opinion, the weekly press briefings, he understood, too, that less was sometimes more. "I know that the public psychology, and for that matter individual psychology, cannot, because of human weakness, be attuned for long periods of time to a constant repetition of the highest note in the scale," Roosevelt wrote in a 1935 letter. His first 2 years in office had been tumultuous as he launched assault after assault on the Great Depression. Now he believed the public needed something of a breather. There is another thought which is involved in continuous leadership. Whereas in this country there is a free and sensational press, people tire of seeing the same name day after day in the important headlines of the papers, and the same voice night after night over the radio. A leader's balancing act, then, was the education and the shaping of public opinion without becoming overly familiar or exhausting. Dignified theatricality is an essential element of power. Whether on stage or on a throne, whether in the Oval Office or in the House of Commons, great leaders are often great performers, able to articulate national purposes and hopes, projecting strength and resolve in moments that threaten to give way to weakness and despair. On the night before Agincourt, Shakespeare's Henry V was racked by doubt and anxiety and fear, only to emerge in the sunlight to transform his men into a fabled band of brothers. FDR's point in his 1935 observation about the need to ration his exposure was that Agincourts are the exception, not the rule. Dwight Eisenhower, who served in the years of the rise of television, used to make the same argument. "I keep telling you fellows I don't like to do this sort of thing," Ike told advisers who urged him to go on the air more often. "I can think of nothing more boring for the American public than to have to sit in their living rooms for a whole half hour looking at my face on their television screens." Presidents, as John Kennedy once observed, are subject to clamorous counsel. Everyone, it can seem, has thoughts on how they could do the job better. When he was being told what to do and how to do it, Eisenhower, who beneath his serene surface had more than a bit of a temper, would reply, "Now look, I happen to know a little about leadership. I've had to work with a lot of nations, for that matter, at odds with each other. And I tell you this, you do not lead by hitting people over the head. Any damn fool can do that, but it's usually called assault, not leadership. I'll tell you what leadership is. It's persuasion and conciliation and education and patience. It's long, slow, tough work. That's the only kind of leadership I know or believe in or will practice. TR would have agreed. In a letter written from the White House in December 1902, the first President Roosevelt described the nature of the office. "Well, I have been president for a year and a quarter. And whatever the future may hold, I think I may say that during that year and a quarter, I have been as successful as I had any right to hope or expect. Of course, political life in a position such as this is one long strain on the temper, one long acceptance of the second best, one long experiment of checking one's impulses with an iron hand and learning to subordinate one's own desires to what some hundreds of associates can be forced or cajoled or led into desiring. Every day, almost every hour, I have to decide very big as well as very little questions. And in almost each of them, I must determine just how far it is safe to go in forcing others to accept my views and standards, and just how far I must subordinate what I deem expedient, and indeed occasionally what I deem morally desirable, to what it is possible under the given conditions to achieve. Often when dealing with some puzzling affair, I find myself thinking what Lincoln would have done. It has been very wearing, but I have thoroughly enjoyed it, for it is fine to feel one's hand guiding great machinery, with at least the purpose, and I hope the effect, of guiding it for the best interests of the nation as a whole. Sound and sensible, and not a bad standard for any president. The way to stand the long strain on the temper is to embrace compromise, seek balance, and strive to serve the national interest, which will be, in the fullness of time, in the personal historical interest of the individual president himself. Seemingly banal points, true, but recent history shows us that what we've long accepted as obvious isn't always as self-evident to a controlling portion of the electorate as one might think or hope. The essential question for voters, then, is discerning the nature of the man or woman who will be standing alone at what Kennedy described as the vital center of action. For, as the Greeks knew, character is destiny. What counts is not just the character of the individual at the top, but the character of the country, its inclinations and its aspirations, its customs and its thought, its attachments to the familiar and its openness to the new. The form of government which prevails, Ralph Waldo Emerson wrote, is the expression of what cultivation exists in the population which permits it. Americans are driven by many forces, and chief among those forces, and thus a formative element in the country's soul, is the pursuit of happiness, of which Jefferson wrote in the Declaration of Independence. When he composed those words in his rented second-floor quarters at 7th and Market in Philadelphia in late June 1776, Jefferson was not thinking about happiness in only the sense of good cheer. He and his colleagues were contemplating something more comprehensive, more revolutionary. Gary Wills's classic 1978 book on the Declaration, Inventing America, put it well. When Jefferson spoke of pursuing happiness, Wills wrote, he had nothing vague or private in mind. He meant public happiness, which is measurable, which is, indeed, the test and justification of any government. Until Philadelphia, the pursuit of happiness had never been granted such pride of place in a new scheme of human government, a pride of place that put the governed, not the governors, at the center of the project. Reflecting on the sources of the thinking on which he drew to draft the Declaration, Jefferson credited the elementary books of public right, Aristotle, Cicero, Locke, Sidney, etc. To understand the Declaration, then, we have to start with Aristotle. Happiness, he wrote, is the end and the purpose of action, the whole point of life. It was an ultimate good, worth seeking for its own sake. Given the Aristotelian insight that man is a social creature whose life finds meaning in his relation to other human beings, Jeffersonian eudaimonia, the Greek word for happiness, which can also mean flourishing, evokes virtue, good conduct, and generous citizenship. Happiness in the ancient and American traditions is as much about the public weal as it is about an individual's endorphins. As Arthur M. Schlesinger, Sr. once wrote, a broad understanding of happiness informed the thinking of patriots such as James Wilson. The happiness of the society is the first law of government, and John Adams. The happiness of society is the end of government. Beginning with the Declaration of Independence, the pursuit of happiness, the pursuit of the good of the whole, because the good of the whole was crucial to the genuine well-being of the individual, and vice versa, became part of the fabric, at first brittle to be sure, but steadily stronger, of the young nation. For Jefferson and his contemporaries, and thankfully for most of their successors in positions of ultimate authority, one of the main points of public life was to enable human creativity and ingenuity and possibility, not to constrict it. In The Rights of Man, his 1791-92 celebration of the centrality of the individual and of the possibilities of human endeavor, Thomas Paine wrote, "From the rapid progress which America makes in every species of improvement, it is rational to conclude that if the governments of Asia, Africa, and Europe had begun on a principle similar to that of America, or had not been early corrupted therefrom, that those countries must by this time have been in a far superior condition to what they are." The progress of which Paine wrote and its enabling agents, reform and revolution, have deep philosophical and political roots. As traced by the Columbia sociologist Robert A. Nisbet, the idea that human nature could advance is found as early as the Greek poets Hesiod and Xenophanes. "The gods did not reveal to men all things in the beginning," the latter wrote, "but men, through their own search, find in the course of time that which is better." And in the myth of Prometheus, who gave men fire. Beyond the pagan world, Saint Augustine spoke of life as a pilgrimage from darkness to light. "The education of the human race, represented by the people of God, has advanced, like that of an individual, through certain epochs, or, as it were, ages, so that it might gradually rise from earthly to heavenly things, and from the visible to the invisible." For the American founders, Enlightenment thinkers such as John Locke, Henri-Robert Jacques Turgot, the Marquis de Condorcet, and Adam Smith, permeated the age with the hope that progress would be possible through inquiry, argument, agitation, and finally reform. At the Sorbonne in December 1750, Turgot articulated the doctrine of progress. "The whole human race, through alternate periods of rest and unrest, of weal and woe, goes on advancing, although at a slow pace, towards greater perfection," he said, in the lecture later published as A Philosophical Review of the Successive Advances of the Human Mind. Like the ebb and flow of the tide, power passes from one nation to another, and, within the same nation, from the princes to the multitude, and from the multitude to the princes. As the balance shifts, everything gradually gets nearer and nearer to an equilibrium, and in the course of time takes on a more settled and peaceful aspect. Of the American Revolution, Turgot wrote, "America is the hope of the human race." Reason, religion, and capitalism were the tributaries that met to form the powerful American River that so impressed Turgot and his contemporaries. By replacing revelation and hereditary authority with rationality and republicanism, the American nation gave political form to the idea that the divine rights of monarchs and prelates had to surrender to the primacy of individual conscience and equality. No longer would certain men, by an accident of birth, kings, or an incident of election, popes, be granted absolute power over the humblest of others. This view of the intrinsic equality of every person, or at least of nearly every propertied white man, drew on secular philosophical insights, the ethos of the Protestant Reformation, and the prevailing culture of the scientific revolution. The rise of market economics was critical, too, for the ability to prosper by dint of one's own initiative created citizens with a stake in preserving and advancing the very society that had given them their chance. Every man, as long as he does not violate the laws of justice, is left perfectly free to pursue his own interest, his own way, Adam Smith wrote in The Wealth of Nations, and to bring both his industry and capital into competition with those of any other man or order of men. To those who worried that the prosperous would close the doors of opportunity behind them, Smith argued that by pursuing his own interest, he frequently promotes that of the society more effectually than when he really intends to promote it. Moreover, in The Theory of Moral Sentiments, published in 1759, Smith wrote that, "How selfish soever man may be supposed, there are evidently some principles in his nature which interest him in the fortune of others and render their happiness necessary to him, though he derives nothing from it except the pleasure of seeing it." In Smith's view, the human capacity for sympathy and fellow feeling could be as much a part of the nature of things as the desire for wealth, and this capacity was essential to the life of a republic. Liberty itself, meanwhile, was dependent on the moral disposition of the populace. Machiavelli, discoursing on these matters, Algernon Sidney, the 17th-century English theorist and politician, wrote, "finds virtue to be so essentially necessary to the establishment and preservation of liberty that he thinks it impossible for a corrupted people to set up a good government, or for a tyranny to be introduced if they be virtuous." Put another way, a republic is the sum of its parts. In the last instance, we are the state, and the state is us. The formation, maintenance, and expression of individual opinion, then, is the motive force of American life, for that opinion will, sooner or later, for good or for ill, manifest itself in the shape and substance of politics. The things we hope for can come to pass. The things we fear can hold us back. What the tender poetic youth dreams and prays and paints today, but shuns the ridicule of saying aloud, wrote Emerson, shall presently be the resolutions of public bodies, then shall be carried as grievance and bill of rights through conflict and war, and then shall be triumphant law and establishment for 100 years, until it gives place, in turn, to new prayers and pictures. Progress in America does not usually begin at the top and among the few, but from the bottom and among the many. It comes when the whispered hopes of those outside the mainstream rise in volume to reach the ears and hearts and minds of the powerful. Words attributed long afterward to Sojourner Truth, who spoke to a women's rights convention in Akron, Ohio in 1851, put the struggles of the day well. "I think that twixt the Negroes of the South and the women at the North, all talking about rights, the white man will be in a fix pretty soon." And those voices carry the farthest when they call for fairness, not favors, for simple justice, not undue advantage. "We ask," Elizabeth Cady Stanton told the New York legislature in 1854, seeking equality for women, "for all that you have asked for yourselves in the progress of your development, since the Mayflower cast anchor beside Plymouth Rock, and simply on the ground that the rights of every human being are the same and identical." Arguing for black enfranchisement in 1867, Frederick Douglass said, "If black men have no rights in the eyes of white men, of course the whites can have none in the eyes of the blacks. The result is a war of races and the annihilation of all proper human relations." Sojourner Truth, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Frederick Douglass. Their voices, articulating the feelings of innumerable others, ultimately prevailed in the causes of emancipation and of suffrage. It took presidential action to make things official, a Lincoln to free the slaves, a Wilson to support the Women's Suffrage Amendment, a Lyndon Johnson to finish the fight against Jim Crow. But without the voices from afar, there would have been no chorus of liberty. The lesson? The work of reformers, long, hard, almost unimaginably difficult work, can lead to progress and a broader understanding of who is included in the phrase, "we the people," that opened the preamble of the Constitution. And that work unfolds still. At Gettysburg, in the spring of 1963, the centennial year of President Lincoln's address at the dedication of the cemetery there, Vice President Lyndon B. Johnson went to the Pennsylvania battlefield to speak at a Memorial Day commemoration. 100 years ago, the slave was freed, Johnson said. 100 years later, the Negro remains in bondage to the color of his skin. The Negro today asks justice. We do not answer him. We do not answer those who lie beneath the soil when we reply to the Negro by asking, patience. The country's fate, Johnson said, was intertwined with the country's sense of fairness. Unless we are willing to yield up our destiny of greatness among civilizations of history, Americans, white and Negro together, must be about the business of resolving the challenge that confronts us now, he said. Our nation found its soul of honor on these fields of Gettysburg 100 years ago. We must not lose that soul in dishonor now on the fields of hate. 5 months and 23 days later, Vice President Johnson became President Johnson in a moment of tragedy and fear when John F. Kennedy, the president Johnson served, was shot to death in the streets of Dallas. On that autumn afternoon, in a crowded cabin aboard Air Force One at Love Field, with the fallen president in a coffin on board, Johnson took the oath of office and ordered the plane to take off for Washington. His mind worrying, the new president, always a man of action, did not believe he had a moment to waste. The battle that Johnson chose in the bleak closing weeks of 1963 was among the most difficult in American history. It was the unfinished work of the Civil War. To understand how the forces of fear had kept equality at bay for a century, and how Lyndon Johnson, an American president thrust to authority by assassination, fulfilled long unmet promises, we must begin the story not in Dallas nor in Washington, but in a village in Virginia called Appomattox Courthouse. Chapter 2. The Long Shadow of Appomattox. The Lost Cause, the Ku Klux Klan, and Reconstruction. The principle for which we contended is bound to reassert itself, though it may be at another time and in another form. Jefferson Davis, after the defeat of the Confederate States of America. We may say that only at the moment when Lee handed Grant his sword was the Confederacy born. Or, to state matters another way, in the moment of death, the Confederacy entered upon its immortality. Robert Penn Warren, The Legacy of the Civil War, 1961. It was, under the circumstances, the most cordial of encounters. On the afternoon of April 9, 1865, Palm Sunday, the beginning of Holy Week, Robert E. Lee, in an impeccable gray dress uniform, surrendered to Ulysses S. Grant at the village of Appomattox Courthouse in Virginia. With a handsome sword and a red sash, Lee met Grant, who wore only a private's blouse with muddied trousers and boots, in the first-floor parlor of a brick house belonging to Wilmer McLean. That morning, Lee had mused about sacrificing himself to enemy fire rather than face the humiliation of capitulation. "How easily I could be rid of this and be at rest," he said, at dawn on the day of his rendezvous with Grant. "I have only to ride along the line, and all will be over." As the story is told, though, Lee mastered his despair. "But it is our duty to live," he said, reassuring himself and his comrades that they still had a mission. "What will become of the women and children of the South if we are not here to protect them?" Grant, who arrived in the early afternoon to find Lee already inside McLean's house, had been suffering from a debilitating headache in the final days of the fighting. Relieved now, quietly, jubilant, he recalled, at the turn of events, the Union general chose to enter the parlor alone, leaving his officers outside for a moment. It was a small sign of respect, even of humility, on the part of the victor to the vanquished. Taking Lee's hand, Grant spoke of their shared experience in the Mexican War. "I met you once before, General Lee," Grant said. "I have always remembered your appearance, and I think I should have recognized you anywhere." They talked on for a bit. Grant was anxious to be gracious, and the past was a safer topic for the moment than the present. At last it fell to Lee to bring up the painful work at hand. "I suppose, General Grant, that the object of our present meeting is fully understood," Lee said. "I asked to see you to ascertain upon what terms you would receive the surrender of my army." The business was handled with dispatch. Grant was magnanimous, allowing Lee's men to keep their horses so that the former Confederates could, Grant said, put in a crop to carry themselves and their families through the next winter. Lee was pleased. "This will have the best possible effect upon the men," Lee told Grant. "It will be very gratifying and will do much toward conciliating our people." The occasion was muted, the generals gracious. These were soldiers, and they understood one another. In defeat, Lee was stoic. In victory, Grant was sympathetic. As he was a man of much dignity, with an impassible face, Grant recalled of Lee, it was impossible to say whether he felt inwardly glad that the end had finally come, or felt sad over the result and was too manly to show it. Whatever his feelings, they were entirely concealed from my observation. But my own feelings were sad and depressed. I felt like anything rather than rejoicing at the downfall of a foe who had fought so long and valiantly and had suffered so much for a cause, though that cause was, I believe, one of the worst for which a people ever